Hello, and welcome to 6 Degrees from the City, a podcast about writing in Western Sydney. I'm your host, Fiona Wright, and I'm delighted to be talking in this episode, our first episode with Lachlan Brown, and not in the least because the title of this podcast comes from his poem from a film, which states, "To exist within this weatherboard valley is to remain always 6 degrees from the city." Lachlan is a poet and the author of two collections, Limited Cities, which was published in 2012, and Lunar Inheritance, which is published this month by Girimondo. Lachlan grew up in Macquarie Fields, but now lives in Wagga Wagga, where he's a lecturer in English at Charles Sturt Uni. I caught up with Lachlan at the Sydney Writers' Festival, sitting at the end of a pier in Walsh Bay and overlooking the harbour.
There's something kind of nice about you know, talking about Western Sydney on the harbour.
It's very different, isn't it? I feel like it's not my space in some ways. It's the sense of intrusion. But also it's illicit, right? You're somewhere where you're not meant to be.
And we talked about inheritance and hoarding and poetry as a means of accounting for places and the objects within them. Here's Lachlan reading from his new work.
I'm Lachlan Brown and I'm reading from a book called Lunar Inheritance, and this is section 3, which is titled Self-Storage. Nearsighted. Another day where the AQI blesses the landscape with sky as white as a Chinese model's white skin. The highway is strung beneath redemptive power lines as your car skims the country of someone's blood. And this flight mode vision means you can know nothing truly, except for the turnoff for Leekong Furniture City, except for a field strewn with broken pots, except for a China shipping container heading to the coast. Uncommon denominators. When she got to Australia in 42, your grandmother gave herself the Western name Sheila, because that's what all the Aussies called her. Your grandfather chose Alan after the brand of sweets sold in his mixed business. Now, every tourist shop offers to write your name in Chinese, but no one can pronounce it in English, and the Australian Embassy publishes Professor on the Writers' Week program. Grandmother Country. First night in Kaiping Centre, and China repeats itself. The same Hong Kong chain stores sit over Bruce Lee's Kung Fu Eatery, which is roundhouse kicking a KFC, where the patrons are rammed in like the chickens they must now eat. But hey, that's capitalism's iterative power, isn't it? KTV soteriology is one price of poverty reduction, and hence tone-deaf singers find passion in small rooms echoed by a chorus of moped alarms. Sorites and Another Traveller's Song. You won't forget the room of clothes, piles rising to fill even those upper corners like light in a Sydney summer. You sense other lives, your imagined family members, sizes for those who will never exist. The future has its own desert seas, waves whipping back against a hoarder's precaution, spilling tracksuited ghosts into this bargain bin present. They whisper the house alive, cursing all dreams.
I'm really glad, actually, that you read those poems. It's some of my favourites in there. I love the poem about your grandparents choosing names.
Yeah.
And your own name being unpronounceable in Chinese.
Yeah. Well, I find my name unpronounceable in America and China and other places
too. In America too?
Well, yes, yeah. Someone at a bagel shop, when I said my name was Lachlan, they wrote, my order came back with Lacken, which was great, L-A-C-K-I-N, which shows this kind of deficiency, and I think it's a great kind of deficiency to have. But yes, yeah, my grandmother, her name is Sheila, and that's what she called herself when she came to Australia. And my grandfather's name was Alan. He passed away when I was very small. A-L-L-E-N. He named himself after the lollies that he sold in the mixed business they had.
My dad's Alan as well, but he was named after Alan Ladd, the actor who played the cowboy in Shane.
Oh, wow.
Who I think my nana had a bit of a crush on.
That's iconic. That's a great name. That's better than naming yourself after a lolly. But
I love it, though, because it's there's sort of this theme that runs through the whole book about misrecognition and not quite belonging.
I think it seems to me that going back to China for the first time, there is this sense of, well, what am I doing here with no Chinese, with a grandmother who wasn't that interested in me going back, whose face was kind of turned to a different, in a different direction. And so the excavations that you do in those places without language mean that you're constantly out of place. But I think, you know, I have the same feeling in Sydney as well of not being quite there or there and not having that same sort of heritage. I mean, it's not overwhelming, but it's interesting to interrogate, I think, poetically.
Yeah, I sort of felt like there were two tensions going on there, that you have that line about the climax of deracinated privilege means you were just selectively retrieving the past, working out what to discard or pocket. But then there's also, it also made me think of that line in Urban Sprawl, in your first book, Limited Cities, where you talk about, I'm somewhere in between, I think.
Like a fallacy.
like a fallacy.
you know, the fallacy of the extended middle, I think, I'm speaking about there. I think, you know, that line about deracinated privilege is there's a sense in which the only reason one can do this kind of project is because that journey from China to Australia in 39 and 40, or to New Guinea in 39 and 42 in Australia was successful.
Yeah.
That it has won something for the generations that came. But also, there are complications there, like my mother not marrying the person she was meant to marry. And so the result of me being here as this kind of in-between figure is, in a sense, the result of that kind of past with it, all its bumps and arguments and difficulties. And so it's the result of that past. But then when you go back into it, you become, for me, it was almost like going into the hoarder's house and saying, well, which bits can I put forward? Which bits can I take back? And in that process of selection, I know that a poet will always be, will never be quite 100% honest, maybe. You're always, the temptation is to withhold and to fashion and to, and so I guess all those things about, you know, taking selfies and thinking about the way that Chineseness is represented and Australian Chinese is represented, that's the big criticism of that, is that you're in a position, you come from this position where you're privileged enough to make those decisions, and there's lots of people who don't have that privilege, I think.
Yeah. So the book came about because of, well, I shouldn't say it that way. One of the main themes in the book is this idea of hoarding, which is very much a family story.
Yeah. My grandmother would not let anyone into her house for many, many years. And then she fell over in Ashfield and broke her hip. And when we finally got into her house, there was just years' worth of stuff. And it was indistinguishable. It was filled rooms in ways that seemed physically not possible. And so my parents spent 9 months, they'd just recently retired, cleaning this house. Wow. And we would help them and taking skip after skip of rubbish away. But they had to go through everything because you didn't know what you might find. Would you find $8,000 in old currency? Would you find 10 McDonald's cups used inside 10 plastic bags inside? Would you find some unmentionable sort of
horror?
Yeah. Well, there were moments of sheer horror, and so it came about from, you know, finding things like my grandfather's naturalization certificate, Sun Yat-sen medallion, but also bags of unmentionable bodily material that you know, and kind of, and meaningless, sort of, in a sense, in inverted commas, meaningless rubbish, like clothes for the children that she was envisaging all her grandchildren having in the future, but they were just kept outside in a passageway, kind of with the rain and the wind, and, you know, they were and so bags and bags of these clothes. So it really came out of that, and thinking through heritage, and then thinking about what China is like now, as a communo capitalist consumptive place where the pace of change is just relentless, and where you know, when you go there, there's this sense of industry and the renewal of cities and of discarding the past in certain ways, architecturally and things. So it was putting those two things together with sort of these notions of identity. I think that's what I was thinking through.
Yeah, and there is this real sense that you've got this kind of brash, loud, you know, capitalism happening on the one sense is almost a natural extension, or hoarding is a natural extension of that.
Yeah, 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 very much so. I mean, aren't you just... Hoarding is a really, you know, it's interesting you say it's an extension of capitalism, because at on the one hand, it's got this a sense of accumulation that you're trying to get as much as you can. But with my grandmother's hoarding, there's also this other sense that everything is valued in strange ways, so that everything seemed to, for my grandma, have equal value. Anything that you could ask her, should we get rid of this? She would say, oh no, that's my X, Y, Z. I need this chair because of this thing, or I need to give this to someone. And so the value of everything became, you know, was placed into flux. And I think, I mean, part of the neoliberal world is that there is this way of valuing and revaluing things as part of, you know, notions of exchange and capital, which I think this you know, was going on in China when I went there.
Or the sense that part of capitalism too is the discardability of things.
So
there's a weird tension there.
There is.
Not discarding things.
So you're really going against the flow in that sense. And in China, I mean, what they're doing, of course, is just wiping away whole sections of cities, hutongs in Beijing, which have a lot of kind of history and culture, are just being swept away in because of modern progress and development and things like that. And so, I mean, even though China as a country is very much, you know, they want to make a lot of the past and the history, the great kind of history of China. There's also, when you look around cities, when you look around places, there's just this rapid sweeping away of the past. And I think, I mean, the artist Song Dong is the other kind of touchstone for this, in that his artwork Waste Not was, what he did was took all the hoarded items in his mother's house in Beijing, I think it was, and then displayed them as an exhibition, lined them up. And she, at the beginning of that exhibition, curated it. So she was able to tell people why she had all these things, soap and everything. But there was a certain sense of care to that that I did not see in my grandmother, that we didn't see in my grandmother's house. It was just, nothing was ordered in a sense. And you know, all the stories were just made up about things and ad hoc when you asked about it.
And you talk about that in the poems too, this sense of making up narrative in reverse. But also, I'm trying to find, there's a T.S. Eliot quote as well. We can connect nothing with nothing because there isn't a story for this material.
Yeah, and I think that's why, that's from The Wasteland. I think, you know, The Wasteland is that poem of disconnection and fragmentation. Yeah. And it's about cities, of course. And so, but that's why I think poetry might be a good form for this, because poetry has that sense of fragmentation and image and, few words that connect in strange ways with other words. Some of the connections are spelt out. Some of them are kind of, as I said in the poem, paratactic, that they're just placed next to one another.
It's funny, I wanted to ask you about form and about parataxis in particular. I know we're both... we're both big fans of parataxis.
Yeah. I just mentioned it in the launch speech for Nathaniel O'Reilly.
Yeah, right.
O'Reilly's book.
But it struck me as very much a kind of hoardily, I want to say technique, but a hoardily aesthetic going on too, where you're sort of pulling things together and just leaving them.
Yeah.
There.
I'm parataxic. I use parataxis in a sense, I guess. And it goes back to, I mean, when you look at Song Dong's artwork, it's everything is laid out next to one another. You know, the 20 little sections of soap, for example, that are all laid out neatly. So there is a sense in which that is the mode for pulling a house and a life apart to kind of see how all the parts might play out. Yeah. But I think, on the other hand, I think it's part of my writerly voice is to try out different connections. So, and I was noticing this as I read through the volume again the other week. One of the things, I mean, there's lots of ways that we connect these things, but one of the things I tend to do is say X but Y. So I've got all these voltas, these turns in the poems that I hadn't noticed when I'd written the book, but they were almost, they seemed to me, it was very difficult to unsee them. They were almost symptomatic of something that you needed. I needed to look away, or I needed to think of another perspective, or I needed to. So that constant switching, I think, is part of. I mean, it's not just a kind of William Carlos Williams like flattening of everything, but it's a trying out of perspectives, I think, perhaps.
And there are moments too, less so in Lunar Inheritance and more in Limited Cities, where some of the switches are almost. Anti-meaning, like there are lines like a pretty girl wearing a face like a pretty girl, or this industrial park is like an industrial park.
I guess they're tautological in a sense. That line about the Wetherill Park industrial area is like Wetherill Park industrial area was taken from one of my students at the University of Sydney, right. Who opened her a piece like that, very unapologetically and not in a non-ironic way. And I just thought, I mean, it was... but there's something about the singularity, I think, of that place that I kind of thought was interesting in that quote, that it's like nowhere else and like everywhere else at the same time.
I have a poet friend who's very against the word like, because he says, you know, something either is a thing or it's not. It's not like something. Wow. And deliberately strips it out of his poems.
See, I always, that's really interesting, because I always think of the engine room of so much poetry that I like, that I enjoy, that I admire, is the simile, the comparison.
And I think you're really good at them. You kind of have really surprising connections, especially with people, like bodies often becoming kind of part mechanical, or spaces too, that this ability to bring two spaces together. So China and Ashfield kind of sit side by side in this book, and in the previous book you had sort of Paris and Macquarie Fields sitting together in the riot poem.
It seems to me when we go to places we take our experiences with us, of course. And so my trips to Paris were... Well, I went there because I wanted to see these places that were rioting in similar ways and structurally similar ways to the parts of Western Sydney that I was from. And so I did see a lot of connection there. I think there's a more kind of threading in terms of the China poems. There's more of a threading of place onto place that you're what I'm doing is thinking back to my childhood growing up in Macquarie Fields, my grandmother living in Ashfield and other parts of Western Sydney, and how that might interact with whatever experiences one has in China. And so you grasp at those things, I think, a little as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way you don't know what you are in Australia until someone yells out fucking gook from the bus window is the way you don't notice the Guangzhou rain is falling until you look up and it has slicked over everything and you find your skin wet and trembling. But the light's polished grey modulations mean people stop double-taking at your distortion pedal face just long enough for you to get past them. Instant vantage. The camera can't quite catch it, though your brain sets its oriental filters with the kind of paratactical manoeuvring that may offer a defence, like those holes in the Dualo balconies meant for shooting bandits and protecting villages. But these Chinese buildings with Western additions, turrets, domes, composite orders, become your selfied face in reverse. Signa Orientalum. When my grandmother tells me that she only received 3 years of schooling in Wailongli, she also adds that she secretly listened to the classroom next door in order to learn more before she was sent to work forever. And so from this Kaiping hotel room, every murmur of traffic becomes a poem, memorized through village walls, or a snippet of my mother's Latin major, reaching out from the past and somehow proving the West right. On Shamian Island. Life of breath, O breath of life. Bird call, ancient trees, quiet traffic across the water, the exquisite scars of colonial architecture. Is this moment a small delegation from the future, the breeze of new creation cutting back across the face of things, a strange ambassador in the teeming city that desires a Kaiping billboard's photoshopped blue skies?
Can we talk a little bit about Macquarie Fields?
Because
it is such an important presence in your first book, Limited Cities, in particular, that the first poem, Urban Sprawl, is sort of very much about Macquarie Fields and thinking through representation of spaces and belonging, I guess, in a way that kind of has continued. So you grew up in Macquarie Fields?
Yeah, so I grew up in Macquarie Fields. I was born in Liverpool Hospital and lived there until I got married and then moved to Macquarie Fields from Macquarie Fields and then moved to the one suburb away, and now I live in Wagga Wagga, which is a lot further away, and teach at the university there. But Macquarie Fields, I think, it seemed to me when I started writing to be a place that was so often ignored or derided. It was seen, you know, it just didn't seem on the cultural map in any way. And that's not to say that, you know, everyone needs to come and write about Macquarie Fields. I mean, John Birmingham had put it into his Leviathan. You know, he comes and hangs out with Macquarie Fields cops see the underbelly of the underbelly of Sydney. But I don't know. There was something about the era. You know, that era of lifestyle supplements in the Herald. Yeah, it seems to me that the West had been ignored. And that's why it's ironic we're doing this interview here as the boats go past in the shadow of the harbour
bridge.
Because there was this sense that real culture happened in the city, that happened at the Writers' Festival on Walsh Bay, which we were at. And that these other places, you know, what do they say about Jesus? Nothing good can come from Nazareth, you know? I feel like the Nazareth. I love Corey Wakeling's recent review in Cordite Poetry Review of the Puncher and Wattman Contemporary Australian Poetry Anthology, in which he says the suburban is the preeminent register of Australian literature. Now, I think it's a very provocative essay in many ways, but he does go on to say, you know, he's very down on the suburbs in certain ways. So, for example, he says suburbs have no public sphere, no public spaces or places where we can have, you know, where are the Habermassy and coffee shops?
Yep.
That's the kind of thinking. Now, I don't know if that's quite true. So my poetry was an attempt to think about them, I guess, in terms of where is the surprise? Where is the beauty? Where is the kind of difficult aesthetic moments here? And those moments can never be pure, of course, because and that's what makes them even more interesting, I think, that they're overridden by capitalism, by government policy, by religion. And so that's what I think part of what I was trying to do there.
But I think that you find those public spaces in public transport more often than not. There are so many train carriages in the book and people having kind of encounters.
Yeah.
Both with other people, but with these kind of moments of real beauty and stillness.
When I went to America and had some students in America were studying my book in near Dallas and in Fort Worth, that's something they remarked on. And they said to their professor, why is this guy always on trains? because, I mean, the suburbs in in Dallas and Fort Worth is all about the car.
Yeah,
and
right.
When I caught the train in public transport in Fort Worth and Dallas, it was not the middle class white people.
Yeah.
It was just a total different section of society, and they're not the ones who would be going to a university at $60,000 a year. But in Sydney, things are very different, of course.
Yeah.
And that train, I think, for me, became a kind of symbol of connection and distance.
Yep.
Yeah,
because there are also iPads on trains. And
yeah, yeah.
You have a lot of people kind of sitting in their little
Yeah, in their spaces.
Yeah.
And the distance, the length that you travel. Yeah. I mean, it's a truism about suburbia that it's defined by the distance between work and home. But that distance, for me, became a conceptual distance, an artistic distance, one that I thought I'd like to try and overcome somehow.
Yeah.
Or, I think there's a pugilistic sense to this as well, and maybe that comes from being involved with the sweatshop
yeah.
guys and being in writing groups with them, that there is a kind of a brio, a bravura, maybe is the right word, about the way you might talk about place and your place.
Yeah.
I
don't know. I was thinking about the trains in particular because I have a story that I tell all the time about the fact that I made the only reason, well, not the only reason, but the main reason I was a literature student or a good literature student was because I had an hour and a half worth of reading time
yeah.
In each direction every day on my way to uni. So
yeah.
I did, you know, one course we were reading a Patrick White novel every fortnight and I was like, yep,
was that
I got
this. Course?
Yeah.
Yes, I did that course.
Yeah, right? But yeah. I was like, I've got this down because I'm spending so long on trains.
Mm, yeah.
So to me, they're a really formative part of, my identity as a writer.
Yeah, I think I'd be the same. You know, I'm the same. I mean, moving to Wagga has meant that I've had to have different modes of creativity and writing practice, I think, without the trains.
I am curious, does Wagga make you think differently about Western Sydney? Because I do think that counterpointing that we often do is, you know, the West versus the city. But the West versus, you know, a rural place seems like a different...
Yeah, there's West and there's West.
Yeah.
Henry Lawson has that. What story is it in? Is it In a Dry Season, where you can go as far as you can go out west? There's always someone who's been further, saying, "I've just come from out bush" or something like that. You know, there's always someone who's gone further. But there is this sense in which
until you hit Perth, right?
Yeah, you just keep going into the interior. And he's mocking that in a sense, but I reckon, Wagga is a very different space in lots of ways to Western Sydney, and it is like moving west. It was interesting that I was speaking to a cultural officer from Wagga recently, and she said, and I was saying, look, it's strange that all the arts funding is concentrated in a small pocket of Eastern Sydney.
Mm.
So that we think of the ballet and the theatre and the
yep.
and the opera and the opera house, and she said, well, it's strange to me that the western suburbs of Sydney are considered regional. So in that the western suburbs have been getting a little bit more funding for the arts because of they are not in this eastern suburbs. But she said, no, we're the real region.
Yeah.
You know, we need this. We need support as well as being really isolated and real, you know. So
The one that always makes me giggle is there's a regional art gallery in Guymere.
Oh, wow.
In the Shire. I mean, they do really great work, but just that wording, regional gallery,
yeah.
always gives me pause.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. So, I mean, conceptually, I don't feel like I can write about Wagga in the same way as that I could write about Western Sydney. You know, I've been very tentative in writing about that, and that could have been one of the reasons that drew me to this project in Lunar Inheritance, which is not writing about necessarily about the place that I was living in at the time.
Although it creeps in small allusions. There's a moment where you're thinking about how you broaden your accent in certain places.
Yes, yeah.
Including the country town in which you now live.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, so I'll do that in Wagga. Well, I'll catch myself doing that in Wagga. My family, on my father's side, my family came from the Central West.
Right.
So my father's family grew up on a farm in Bajarabong, which was a very small town just outside of Forbes.
Okay.
And so... Yeah, so there is that kind of connection to the country. And my parents met at Leeton when my mother was a French teacher and my father was working for the Department of Agriculture. So, you know, there is this regionality that's going on in the background there. But I think I am aware of the ways that, you know, we act and we try and fit in the places we are.
Mm. Yeah. And I often wonder if it is just the lot of the writer to not quite fit in any of the places.
Yeah, I mean, that gives you the kind of little bits of distance, doesn't it? Those toeholds into an artistic piece, I think, that you're seeing something fresh. I mean, when I went to China, someone said to me, "Look, you need to write straight away, because now is the time when everything is fresh, when you're seeing things with new eyes, when you're not part of wherever you are, that the most interesting things are going to come out.
Those moments of strangeness."
Yeah, moments. And I think, I mean, that's what I love about your poetry, that you can, I think, do that in particular places. And I think you've done it in Wagga. I remember the Backdoor Cafe and, the Gobbegobolan Bridge, your description of driving over the Gobbegobolan Bridge. I think it was like flying over the landscape. You know, I'd driven over that bridge for a couple of years before you wrote that, but I'd never, you know, it caused me to see that space in a new way, which
is... That's my favourite thing that poetry does, just in general, to give you connections that you hadn't made before or new sets of eyes to see things with.
Yeah, I think so. And part of that, I think, is, you know, my favourite quote about the suburbs is Jennifer Maiden's... I want to mention this quote by Jennifer Maiden because it's one of my favourite quotes about the suburbs. And she says something like, the suburbs are the place... Or she says the suburbs show us the gift of the unexpected, which I really like. But then she says, nowhere else can the eternal and the eternally reversing dialectic between icon and iconoclasm be so sharply observed, or something like that. So it's a really... kind of difficult quote, but I think, you know, I see it all around when I go back to parts of Sydney, that there is this kind of iconoclasm, which I love, that the things that high culture might esteem, that places might tell us are great, that the suburbs will really bring them low, and they will, the objects of worship, of course, will be the McDonald's sign, will be the... but that's not just true for those moments. Like, will be, I think, in Luke Carman's book, the hidden petrol cap that is found, which I think is a profound moment in his book. So the icons are very different. And of course, that's always shimmering and oscillating and reversing and reversible, which I just think that's what makes the suburbs or some suburbs so interesting for me.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, too, that that quote speaks to with the icons and... that sense of worship, because I do think one of the wonderful things that you bring to the suburb, in your poems, is this sense of the spiritual, and these kind of luminous moments that kind of puncture the everyday. And there's lots of almost song lines in there, like "Oh, to be back in the suburbs at dusk," and I've had a few of them.
I'm interested in the ways that poets deal with this, with space in that way. Like, for example, Jill Jones's "Where We Live" does something similar. It's just this liturgical voice that surrounds what, you know, she goes out with her partner Annette, who does photographs, and then between the two of them, they are able to kind of encounter this space of like abandoned rubber ducks and toe balls. But sing the beauty of that space, and she'll deploy the kind of spiritual register, and it's in tension with the kind of postmodern idea that, you know, we can't find or make out any sense of all this. And so I think what they do is really remarkable. But I guess mine is something similar, but it's from having a background as someone of faith, someone who would call himself a Christian, and so. That background of seeing, I mean, it's not Hopkins, you know, the world is charged with God's grandeur, and it is Hopkins in a sense, but it's like, what does Hopkins look like in this fallen place, this place where humans have kind of proliferated and expanded and are doing strange things. So it's trying to take that lens and put it over this space. But I think, you know, I'm a particular kind of Christian, and so my heritage is a kind of evangelical heritage, and that raises all kinds of issues and problems because, and interesting sort of affordances, I think, because evangelicalism is often seen as anti-aesthetic and pragmatic. Mm. And I think the suburbs are often seen the same way as anti-aesthetic and pragmatic. So I think there's an interesting dialogue that I haven't worked out yet between that. You know, because the evangelical will say, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if the song's good or if the building's good, it's all about the saving of souls, you know. And and so there's a lovely sense of, you know, you won't go into the evangelical church and necessarily see the beautiful, have the beautiful incense in the choirs and, and the buildings, but the doctrine will be the important thing. So, yeah, I want to bring that into connection somehow with the way I think of suburbia, because I think there's an overlap there. Like, but I haven't quite worked out what that is. I'll just keep doing it, I think.
Yeah, something to keep exploring. And you mentioned the rubbish there too, like finding the beauty in the rubbish. And it was funny, like reading Limited Cities again after reading Lunar Inheritance, I kept noticing the kind of small accumulations of rubbish and debris that become part of that landscape as well, especially sort of, you know, there's a train line with prams and blackberry bushes.
Yeah.
Just all these little moments where, you know, the rubbish kind of stands in its own spotlight for a second.
I love that poem because it takes me back to a specific moment of walking through Macquarie Fields from my house to the station over the kind of... We all get to walk over creeks all around Sydney, but the creek that it had been raining and it was just flushed with... just had all this debris, but there was a joy to that. It was a day like today with beautiful blue skies and sunlight, and maybe my exams had ended. But there is a kind of Gloria moment, you know, the angels singing Gloria, even in this, even in the rubbish. And I mean, this is not to say that we leave the rubbish. I remember our church doing Clean Up Australia Day with some locals. Like, there was, in Macquarie Fields, there wasn't many people doing Clean Up Australia Day. Like, it's just, it's like Sisyphean task. So we were in the scrub in between James Meehan High School and Macquarie Fields shops, and just finding all kinds of things and just bags and bags and bags. And then at the end of the day, you just look and there's just the same amount of rubbish. And we're doing it with these kids who come to our youth group and who'd just been expelled from school for threatening to bash their teachers with baseball bats and stuff. But they were lovely. I mean, we got on really well with it. So I mean, it's like you can't escape that. And I mean, maybe I needed to have that sort of joy with my grandmother's rubbish, but I don't think... I mean, it was very close and much more difficult and fraught, I think.
Well, it's a personal kind of rubbish in a way that, you know, rubbish that doesn't belong to you.
Yeah, and you have to... It's like you have to wade through and push through to find the person. And that's the... I mean, I've got a poem in the book where... speak about the rubbish displacing my grandmother, because her house got so full, we think, that she got a shed made in the backyard, and she used to sleep in this corrugated iron shed because the house was filled with rubbish, which was just incredible to think about, her doing that. The clearing the rubbish is this, on the one hand, attempt to get back a normal sense of life and to find the life of the person who is in there somewhere. But also when you're doing that, it's incredibly traumatic for that person. So they abuse you and they are not happy at all.
Well, I think that's the case with, you know, mental illness of any sort, that when the behaviours that keep you safe are threatened, you lose the plot. I've done some terrible things. And
so within a certain context, things make perfect sense.
Yeah, and it's just because your rational brain is switched off. You can't access it through all of that. It's incredible.
But, I mean, we had these, you know, we had all these moments of each one of us at different times would just lose it.
like.
Yeah.
You just, the amount of this rubbish is just so intense that, you know, and I remember one moment where my grandmother was saying to me, you can't take these chairs. They're really good chairs. They're, you know, and they were just bits of metal with no seats or anything. And I said, is it still good now? I was standing on the top of the skip like Thor or something in the middle of, in the middle of the road, and I said, is it good now? And I just smashed it on the ground. I just dropped it on the ground, and it just splintered everywhere, and I felt so guilty after that moment, you know, because I'd lost it. But each one of us at different times would just have had enough. And I you know, I in no way was doing as much as my parents were. That was just like after a few days.
What a job. The other interaction with your grandma in the book that I really love is the moment when you tell her that you're going back to Kaiping and Guangzhou.
Yeah.
And she says, why don't you go to Taiwan? It's richer.
Yeah. So, I mean, I said that she had no sense of heritage. Well, it was very difficult to get that from her. And I think, I mean, what she is thinking about, even though I was married at the time, is like, where do you find your husband and wife? So she was still that sort of in that mode, I think. Where do we get the rich partners for our children? We go to Taiwan and find them. And I think she was, it's part of that sort of getting by, I think. So my little brother's moved to Hong Kong.
Right.
And so he's just moved to Hong Kong in the last couple of months, but she's really happy with that because it's a rich area. Right. There's opportunity there. But the fact that you might go back to a village which is no longer there, just it was like I was speaking about some other
it just world. Really resonated with me because I remember, so my grandfather was a soldier in the Second World War. He put his age up to go in there, and a few years before he died, my brother, you know, who's always been, you know, he loves Anzac Day and has always been interested in things like that, had decided that he was going to do the Kokoda track, you know, like a lot of young men, especially suburban young men, let's face it, do. And he mentioned this to my pop, and my pop just like lost it essentially and was like, I don't know why you want to do that. We did that so that our grandkids wouldn't have to.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was quite remarkable, this sort of moment of what we imagine as our inheritance and what...
And paying some kind of tribute or... connecting.
And what those who came before us just don't imagine for us, I guess.
Yeah. And it's almost like you're forcing... By talking about it, you're forcing them to relive that trauma.
Yeah.
So my thought is, you know, part of my thought with my grandma is, well, what is it about this place that she doesn't want to speak about? And it is the grinding poverty. It is the 3 years of schooling, if she's to be believed. Yeah. And there are probably other things going on as well, other family issues, particularly, I mean, that's another theme of the book, are these matrilinear relationships between my great-grandmother and grandmother and my grandmother and mother that are never never simple, and they're never entirely benevolent either. So my grandmother is very upset that my great-grandma only allowed her 3 years of schooling. It was something she brings up all the time. And on that poem I read, she speaks about, you know, I was so clever, I got to listen through to the next form up above and I learnt this poem, and she recited the poem for me in Cantonese. But then it was just gobsmacking to me that my grandmother then would say to my mother, you can't go to university, you've got to get married. That kind of would be passed on to the next generation, as it were. And of course the boys don't have this issue, but it's the girls, particularly in a culture in which that these things are valued very differently, I think. Mm.
Did your mother go to university?
She did. Yeah, she got a scholarship. She moved out of home, so she didn't marry the person that she was meant to marry. She lived with an old lady from Paddington Church of Christ.
Amazing.
And she went to Sydney University and studied Latin and French and teaching.
That's so good. Mm. My mother got a teaching scholarship
too.
Yeah,
they got those things.
Yeah, that's how she left. She was, she was in the country and wasn't expecting to go to university, and then because they were poor, and then suddenly could.
Mm. Yeah, it's incredible.
You know, and so I feel that too. That the life that we have, like her children have, being comfortably middle class in the suburbs, is so different to even the way that she grew up.
Mm. Yeah, that sense of something being generationally one, I think.
Mm.
And it's quite pronounced. I mean, you know that great show on Netflix, Master of None?
Yes.
In season one, there is this wonderful episode of the generational gap between the first generation and second generation immigrants, and the Chinese and the Indian. And I think, I guess that's part of the difficulty of my book, is that I can't really envisage what it meant for that generation to have won what they want, to get where they are.
At such cost, too.
Yeah, very much so. Mm.
Mm. All right, well, I reckon that's a good note to end
on. Oh, thanks so much.
No, thank you.
City is supported by the Crown Packer Foundation, the Sydney Review of Books, and the Writing and Society Research Centre at Western Sydney University. Our theme music is by Phil Fadul, a composer from Parramatta. You can find more of his work online by following the link in our program notes. Thank you for joining us for this, our very first episode, and please stay tuned. You'll be hearing from us again very soon.